Hello and welcome to a PrivCap podcast. My name is David Snow. I'm a partner with PrivCap Media. And today we're joined by three experts who are going to be walking us through these interesting times, but through the lens of investor relations. I'm going to ask each of them to introduce themselves, starting with Mona Marquardt.
Hi, thank you, David. This is Mona Marquardt. I am a partner at InRider Partners. InRider Partners was founded to deliver best practices investor relations to GPs and their LPs on an outsourced basis. And prior to founding InRider earlier this year, I led a series of sales and IR initiatives at Morgan Stanley Investment Management, Fortress Investment Group, and Abbott Capital, and was most recently a managing director at Trailmark, the private equity-focused placement agent.
Thanks. And how about you, Gary?
My name is Gary Cernovitz. I've been doing investor relations and business development at Lime Rock for 16 years. We're an energy-focused private equity firm with about $9 billion of AUM in two oil and gas strategies and now a new clean energy strategy.
And over to you, Michael Elia.
Thanks, David. I'm Mike Elia. I'm a partner at StepStone based in New York. I'm on the research team covering mid-market buyout and secondary funds. Working closely with clients on portfolio construction, and of course, I'm receiving all the information from Mona and Gary on a pretty regular basis. Prior to StepStone, I worked at OPA and came out with a number of the best practices, principles 2.0, templates, and reporting that many folks are still using today.
And Michael, first question for you is, are you professionally attired today? Because if you were just sitting at home in your sweats, then that would probably be disrespectful to our audience.
Actually, for you, I actually put on a collared shirt today. So yes, I am.
Oh, wow. Wow. This is going to be a fancy webinar. But before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge the ACG New York for being our partner on this webinar. So we thank them for helping to spread the word. And why don't we kick it off? First question, maybe starting with Mike, since you are in touch with many GPs. Let's start with the fact that investor relations professionals need to organize physical events every year, AGMs, and a lot of these are getting canceled and postponed. What are you seeing out there?
Yes, we have slowly seen these events get canceled over time, and quite frankly, they have to be canceled because you can't have, depending on the jurisdiction, you can't have more than 4, 10, or so many people together, and quite frankly, nobody can travel anyway. So yes, we have seen things being canceled or rescheduled into the fall. I think what we're seeing is a domino effect of events tripping all over each other in the fall because there were pretty regular events. Others really are shifting to something that we're doing right now, more of a webinar delivery platform. And trying to stick to their dates and, of course, compressing it down to get the information out to their LPs.
And Mona, what are you seeing in the world of AGMs?
Pretty much what Mike was mentioning, we really think best practice is sticking to the date that you already had set, even if it's in the next couple of months, if at all possible. For a couple of reasons. One, it's already on your investors' calendars, and as you mentioned, we can't have everything compressed into the autumn. But also maintaining the schedule that you put out there in this environment where everyone is so stressed and so worried builds some sense of stability, builds trust. We're anticipating that the first AGMs that are delivered virtually, whether they're teleconference or video conference, are going to be pretty rudimentary, pretty basic. People are just looking to get information out there. But really pretty quickly, LPs are going to get accustomed to this format, and we'll see some GPs starting to deliver pretty refined virtual AGMs. So there is a need to think forward about how you're going to convert what was an event that you had kind of a nice routine for to a much more compressed time frame. Shifting to an agenda that's appropriate for a virtual setting, and even changing the way your content looks, because you're going to need to shake up what's on the screen so you don't have people, zoning out and going to get coffee and walk the dog in the middle of your AGM.
Gary, you're probably, you know, very much in touch with your LPs right now. What's the general mood around, you know, the impact that this crisis is gonna have?
Yeah, I think first people are being human and probably comparing it to the, you know, depending on your age, the two prior of, you know, similar-ish events of a lifetime and sort of the global financial crisis and 9/11. I think after that, there is, you know, right now we are solely in getting the facts and getting your bearings, you know, asking about capital call pace, trying to get an early handle on valuations and really in a fact gathering mode. I get a sense anecdotally that, you know, the global financial price crisis kind of helped people prepare, or at least people in the business for this sort of mentally. There doesn't seem to be sort of the, you know, the rumor mill around, you know, LPs asking people to not call capital or defaulting or that kind of stuff. So it does feel, at least among the LPs, and maybe it's a benefit of having, you know, sort of 12-year bull market gains kind of behind their balance sheets, that they're a little better, but it is generally just, you know, first on the human level, you know, kind of adjusting, but also second, just really just basic, you know, what are the facts right here?
Yep. I'd like to remind our audience that they can begin sending in questions as soon as now. We may not get to all the questions, but we already have a good one, and I'd like to present it to both Mona and to Mike, which is, do you think that LPs would feel that a virtual AGM is suitable? Would they accept that, or do they demand to press the flesh in person? Maybe starting with Mike.
Sure. I think, look, LPs are starved, to Gary's point. They're starved for information and data. Luckily, I think the LPs are well-suited to this unfortunate event. Those that have gone through it 12 years ago, they know the questions to ask and how quickly to start asking them. So questions of, when are you going to call capital? What does your deal flow look like? Please tell us about your portfolio and valuations. Those questions have already started bombarding IR folks all around the world. So I think a virtual AGM is suitable for now. I don't think it's a permanent replacement because people need to meet the people they're giving money to. So I think it will hold us over through this time of need, but we will have to go back to the standard way of doing things eventually.
Agreed. It's absolutely acceptable now, and LPs are understanding of whatever format can be put out there for the time being. They don't even need to see the presenters on the screen, provided they can see the presentation. I think there are questions about for even the, you know, the end of the year for those AGMs. If we do see a resurgence in cases after the summer, for example, will we need to be in virtual throughout all of 2020? But most LPs see AGMs, particularly the large ones, as an important networking opportunity and ongoing due diligence opportunity. There is a possibility that some LPs, particularly those in less central locations, are going to want this as an option in future years. You know, those folks with very small teams and limited travel budgets. But you know, we anticipate that GPs are going to try to move back to in-person as soon as possible.
Gary made an interesting point about the great financial crisis maybe helping to prepare some people for this moment. And Mike, in our previous communications, you made an interesting point about you actually think that in general the LPs are better prepared for this than the GPs.
Yeah, they are. Actually, I'm pretty proud of the LPs this time around. If you recall what happened last time, there was a wave in the last boom time, 06, 07, of distributions coming through, and a lot of commitments were made. I like to say they're kind of the freshmen with their first credit card. And so commitment pacing went through the roof in 06 and 07 and just died afterwards. We had the denominator effect. We had a lot of different issues impacting LPs. This time around, we've been talking about this for 3 years now, right? We were not talking about a healthcare disaster, but we were talking about some sort of recession. So a lot of LPs actually have an allocation to cash. They're prepared. They knew exactly what to do to see what their liabilities were and what their pacing is. And quite frankly, the CIOs and the heads of PE they really want to stick to their pacing through this downturn to make sure that they don't miss out on some of the good opportunities that are coming up. That said, this all will depend on how long this lasts. If this is a 3-6 month issue, that's one thing. If this is an 18 month issue, I think we have bigger issues going on.
We're jumping around a bit, but we're really getting some good questions coming in, and this one's a bit technical, but I think we should take it anyway. Maybe this can be for Mona. It says, you know, how do you choose between canceling or rescheduling your meeting? Again, a bit technical, but, you know, we have some people in our audience who do this for a living, so.
Yeah, no, and I'm seeing those, and we should assure the person who asked if this webcast is live or recorded that it is live. So in terms of canceling or rescheduling, to cancel, you know, as Michael was saying, there's important information that needs to be communicated, and AGM is a really efficient way to do that, and for the GP to put its strongest foot forward in a more formal setting. So to cancel it pulls that away from your investors who, you know, are looking to see that GPs are being good stewards of their capital and also good stewards of information. So we would be strongly biased toward rescheduling or retaining the date and changing it to a virtual session. And likewise, a technical question about the time that was appropriate and whether, you know, 3 to 4 hours is reasonable. 4 hours would definitely be pushing it. Probably, you know, 2.5 to 3 hours is the max. And you have to plan for logistics. You have to plan for bathroom breaks after an hour and a half. You have to definitely vary the way the presentations are being delivered so that it doesn't all blur together because there's not that in-person impact.
And good point. And thanks for answering the question about, you know, is this event live or was it pre-recorded? No, it's live. And a good point to make to people who are thinking of planning virtual meetings, you know, touching on what Mona was talking about, is there can be a big chunk of the meeting that is pre-recorded and it's prefabricated, whether it's videos or other types of material. But then there's always needs to be the portion where the LPs want to ask you questions, and that is necessarily live. Maybe Gary, question for you. We're again jumping around a bit, but you know, people are going to be really interested in valuations. What is the right way? What is the most responsible way to communicate with LPs about expectations around valuations, especially in a huge valuation swoon like what's happening now?
Yeah, it's it's a huge issue internally, you know, and externally, and I'm surprised by we're already getting communication from our LPs about what other GPs are already telling them of where they expect things to be. And we got one on Wednesday that said they expect things to be down about 15% in the energy sector. And I sent that to one of my colleagues, and someone said, is that an April Fool's joke, Gary? Is that, have they invested in a Zoom toilet paper and gummy bears as their entire portfolio and their energy portfolio? So I think it's a huge, huge issue. You know, what we're going to try to do is just, you know, be very, very, you know, transparent methodologically with folks. Clearly, everyone LP understands two things. One, you know, private market transactions that happened last year and the last 5 years are not relevant in this market. And there is no kind of newly established private market transaction in this market. And, you know, this is, I think, broadly applicable, but definitely to our sectors. And you just have to kind of accept that. I think the second thing that happens in a crisis like this is public market valuations are also hard to fathom. You know, what you have, and I used to be a sell-side equity research analyst, is sort of the stocks fall faster than the estimates from the analysts who are waiting for company guidance. So you'll have things that, you know, technically you pull down from Bloomberg, it's trading at 3x EBITDA, when in fact it's probably trading at 6 or 7 times what real EBITDA is. So I think given those two technical problems, everyone understands that. My advice would be, you know, use this first quarter letter to kind of talk, you know, broadly about how you're approaching valuation this quarter. You know, show some humility, and, you know, we're all in this together, and there are no perfect and absolute objective answers in a market like that, but just make it so people can easily follow what you're doing. instead of sort of mumbling about discounted cash flows that no one has any transparency into inputs, or provided that transparency into inputs, because I think that's what people are going to be looking for. You know, are you being honest in a very, very difficult time with no absolute right answers given the market backdrop?
Mike, thoughts on valuations and reporting in troubled times?
Yeah, sure. If you think of the communications that GPs have sent out, and we've probably had, we're tracking them all. I think we've had 300 one-on-one calls with GPs in the last 3 weeks. And they've fallen into different categories, right? At first, GPs reached out and said, look, we're still here. We're working from home. We hope everything's all right. We hope everyone's well. The second round of communication was more on categorizing their portfolio companies. Here's the red, yellow, green. Here are the things and issues that we think may be a problem. The dynamic is changing every day, but we'll stay in communication with you. The third is, to your point, was valuations. Here are estimates where we think things will come out for 3/31, because at this point, 12/31 doesn't matter. LPs are looking at 9/30, and they're saying, oh my God, where are we going to be on 3/31? At StepStone, we actually created, probably got a horrible name, a COVID dashboard where we can map out all the portfolio companies of an LP to see where those valuations will end up on 3/31 if by GICS code they pretty much follow the public markets, and you can toggle that correlation. And so that we're estimating anywhere from a 15 to a 17% drop in NAV from 9/30 to 3/31. But GPs need to communicate, because you can't just take a broad brush. And if they can communicate those valuations to them, that is helpful for them to figure out their pacing. I will say LPs this time have a different strategic asset allocation, so they don't have quite that broad public market exposure. So the denominator effect, even though it is hitting them, it's not as bad as it was the last time around. And David, the last point to kind of wrap it up is all those annual meetings that are coming up, that would kind of tie a bow on those three different components of information to tell them about, okay, to Gary's point, where are we going forward in this market? Because whatever pipeline we had, it's going to be a bit different going forward.
I'd like to move on to the topic of fundraising, but first we do have a question from an audience member that sort of touches on what all of you have already discussed, but it just kind of makes it's a bit more pointed. And it's, are LPs really going to sit and listen to a 3 to 4 hour online event? You know, does anyone actually want to do that, or would it drive them crazy? So maybe starting with Mona.
Yeah, and I touched on this a little bit before, but I think it definitely has to be a shorter event. And, you know, the few that have taken place so far have been more in the 2.5 hour range. So you're really compressing a lot, and you're probably not going to have your portfolio company CEO speaking if they're in the middle of crisis management. But again, really important to make sure that the technology is tight and your presentations are tight and visually differentiated from each other, so that people are engaged. Also important to try to engage your audience if the platform allows for it, like this one does, to ask questions. You know, you can certainly solicit questions or maybe even put a poll out there at the beginning of each presentation. So there's something to, you know, keep them feeling like they're in the room, even though they're all at different locations.
Great. I'd like to move on to fundraising, which is a big topic, obviously, and maybe we can continue with you, Mona, for the moment. And I guess the first part is, make your prediction about how overall fundraising is going to be impacted by basically this complete shutdown and travel and meetings for 2020. And then what are some ways that people raising funds can continue to maintain contact with potential investors in this restricted environment?
Well, predictions are challenging, but what we're hearing is that LPs, you know, by and large, and you know, Michael was saying the same, are looking to stay as much on plan as they can, given many unknowns. We have definitely heard that a meaningful percentage are looking to reduce the amount of capital that is put out, you know, by some amount, unclear. Maybe that really shows up in terms of same size commitments, but to a fewer number of funds simply because of the logistical challenges. It seems like things are going to be, you know, fairly quiet right now, especially as many institutional investors are resetting to working from home, figuring out what their processes are. They probably have other delays that are wholly unrelated to, you know, to their fundraising diligence process. But, you know, does seem to be working on moving forward in general, albeit at a reduced percentage of what last year was. On the question about how to make connections, and I know some people have asked, like, when is it inappropriate or when is it, you know, no longer tacky to try to contact a new investor. Investors do seem like they're most interested in maintaining relationships with existing GP relationships. So that's where their dollars are most likely to go. Those are the calls they're most likely to be taking. But for funds that are in process, certainly, you know, you've established existing dialogue there, and that can continue. Probably the first outreach you want to do at this point, which should be happening right about now, is a general check-in just to see how people are, to see, you know, what their processes look like, and really not pushing any information about the fund that you're talking about at this point in time. You want to demonstrate you're concerned about them first, and is this a good time, and, you know, when will be a good time to talk. For new relationships, you know, that is tougher, and that is where if you're using a placement agent or you're thinking about using a placement agent, that can be really valuable because they will have personal relationships that are existing for them even if they're new for your fund, and that can add to the fund's outreach.
Gary, number one, predictions about how 2020 is going to look as a fundraising year, and then suggestions about best practices in the current environment.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is a time where, you know, when the phone rings, it's very rarely going to be good news. You know, we are in the market with two funds. You know, no one's calling. It's like, can we move up the first close? I think the three challenges folks are going to have are one, you know, right now, you know, kind of as mentioned, folks, you know, yeah, I just talked to one of the largest Canadian plans yesterday, and they're like, all we're doing right now is we finish some re-ups earlier in this year, and we are just looking at the portfolio. We're not even thinking about anything. And it's like, you know, and then so I think one is you have no mind share as folks are on that. And, you know, and so, and they said, we're going to start, you know, after there's some stability in the markets and human life. So, you know, for every individual, you can enter your own estimate of stability in the markets and human life, which you have an infinite range of probably opinions on that. And, you know, add, you know, 6 weeks, 2 months until kind of, you know, to Mike's point, you know, kind of normal business and, you know, kind of people can even have the space to think about it. And I think the second challenge is obviously, you know, just sort of how people think about various subsectors of private equity, you know, and talking to one LP, you know, about, you know, not one of our funds, but another fund, you know, just kind of thought about it. It's a little bit of a luxury, bull market luxury, if you will. Yeah, like, let's get exposure to that niche sector, where she mentioned, like, all they're interested right now is, you know, the most, you know, kind of market response, buy things at the bottom. And that tends to not be done ideally in a 5-year draw down private equity, you know, illiquid fund. It's better in credit. It's better in public. So I think, you know, it's going to, you know, I think you're going to suffer both of those. One is just sort of everything's frozen for a while. You know, to Mike's point, it doesn't feel like people are telling you, like, we're not doing anything forever again. But I think the second one is, you know, depending on how niche or specialized your strategy is, you know, you may just be seen as just a sort of general a second priority now, given more sort of market timing, sort of liquid strategies.
Mike, predictions on the 2020 fundraising market, and also thoughts on, you know, the right way to basically ask people for money in these trying times.
Yeah, well, both of those are probably not what people want to hear today. Look, I think existing relationships will still be able to raise money. ODD has been done on those organizations. There's already a GP-OP relationship in place. We've seen actually some GPs in this market move up some of their closes. Other closes that were scheduled for April are still going on as planned. We can thank the governor of California for waiving the Brown Act, because now all the California plans can actually meet over the phone and continue their business. But I will say that business is still focused on all of the existing things that were in the pipeline. I think LPs are saving that little bit to be, to Gary's point, opportunistic. We, of course, tell our clients that if you think there's an opportunity now, you probably should have committed last year, so you're too late, you missed it. Many of our clients have had springing relationships on the credit side. So again, their focus has shifted over there. So I think fundraising will be tougher this year, less for the established names and established relationships. To one of the comments, questions on the board, first-time funds will be hard. If you can get the story out there, but it will be very hard for you to make a connection with an LP over the phone. And quite frankly, I don't know anyone that's really written a check to a first-time manager without having met them in person. So I think communication, education can happen, but quite frankly, until meetings can happen in person, those funds will probably have to wait until the beginning of Q3 to start fundraising.
Here's an interesting question, and maybe it's one that Mike can take, anyone. It's pretty technical, but it's really interesting. And that's, how do you handle requests for secondary transactions in a market like this? Have you seen that yet, Mike?
Yeah. So secondary transactions, it's kind of interesting. They need to be priced on something. And so to our discussion earlier, 9:30 valuations are no longer relevant. 12:31, though just rolling out, are also no longer relevant. You need to price it from something. And from, you know, if you think of a traditional secondary and LP selling as a fiduciary, you need to know what you're selling off of. So you need to have that pricing in place. I think the market is effectively on hold until we can get some clarity on what the future looks like and what some of these valuations look like. And quite frankly, I think this time around, if you think of the secondary market last time around, the banks had a lot of assets that needed to be sold off. LPs had a lot of liquidity issues. This time around, I think the LPs, though some may slow down their commitment pacing, I think they're managing their cash quite well. So I think the secondary transactions going forward will be on the GP side. And the GP side of the market has been quite busy, and GP-led restructurings will probably be where we see more transactions as the fallout starts hitting these portfolio companies.
Gary or Mona, thoughts on the secondaries market, or should we move on to another question?
I just
the
had a
one thing that
joke. Sorry, Mona, go ahead.
Yeah, the one thing I was going to add is, because I agree with everything Mike was saying, and I do think the secondary funds are, you know, gearing up and getting ready to be very active around GP-led secondaries. But for those funds that do have any meaningful high net worth investor base, where folks are affected across their, you know, their broad portfolio and having massive impact due to oil and other, I could imagine we would see a number of smaller secondary positions that are looking to move pretty quickly.
Gary?
Oh, no, it was just, if someone calls you up and says, we wanted to launch a secondary transaction, what is your thought? My thought is, poor, poor man. You know, that's it's not obviously a good time in any context of any asset, you know, whether it's a house or a secondary, to kind of do it now. So I would try to discourage them if they are friends of yours to do that. It would not be fun.
Yep. Here's a question for anyone, and maybe we could start with Mona. It's a question for the audience, and it's just saying, like, how worried are you about conveying information to your investors today that could be completely different tomorrow? How do you, it's a bit of a broader question, but you know, how do you handle that?
Yeah, I think the only mitigating factor there is that everyone is in the exact same boat, and everyone is worried. I have heard GPs say that they are, one example is a GP who is avoiding categorizing their companies, red, yellow, green, because they don't want to be in a position down the road of having a company go out of business that they did not have in a red category at this point in the year. But on the flip side, investors are looking for that level of bucketing, so they know what they need to worry about now. And I think everyone is anticipating that things are going to change potentially pretty dramatically over the next couple of quarters. I don't have a great answer except that everyone is dealing with the same thing, and I believe that investors are accepting of the fact that we know information is going to change and it should be on a best efforts basis. And Mike might want to add to that.
Yeah, I don't think you could hold a GP to something they said in the month of March or April, because whatever was true at the time, we don't know what's going to happen in the next few weeks. We really don't. So I think as long as you give your an intelligent, common sense response, I think that's more than fair. I think they're just trying to figure out how their portfolio is going to be impacted, and you guys are on the front lines with the information.
And I'd add to that, which is no one is going to remember a specific portfolio company color shading now. 5 years from now, they will remember a judgment they made on your character as an individual and as a manager. So if they feel like, you know, your valuations are not right, if they feel like, you know, as one LP told me, they got a letter from one of their GPs where the signature of the block of all the partners was longer than the actual content, and that's all they've heard. You know, that kind of stuff is going to be remembered 5 years from now, and most importantly, going to be remembered next time you ask people for money, more so than any individual factual data point. So keep that in mind, where it's almost like a binary, where these are good people that are in the foxhole with us in this crisis, versus these folks are kind of fronting or stonewalling or just sort of not being good partners.
Yeah, Gary,
let me follow. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, David, I think Gary hit the nail on the head. Right now, it's all about communication and how the LPs feel, how they're being treated. That's what they will remember. So that in good times and bad, the GP communicated with the LP, gave them the information based on whatever information they had at the time, and the LP will go away feeling they communicated, they interacted. If you sit back and wait until you have all the answers to give the full response back to the LP, they're going to be on the other end going, where are these guys and why haven't they told me what's going on? So I think communication, over communication. I mean, my gosh, the weatherman goes on my TV 3 times a day and 2 out of 3 times he's wrong, but I still turn him on. So I think communication is key.
And one other random point, David, is just, yeah, this is a personal sort of pet peeve of mine, but yeah, it's sort of the communication should be about what you know. I got forwarded another GP who was kind of musing around the coronavirus and sent that to all the LPs. I think, you know, if you're Howard Marks, you have people want to know what you think about the general economy. But for most private equity firms, you know, that you are not being asked to, you know, predict, kind of the pace or the shape of recession and recoveries. You're being asked about what you know and what can control. And the more time you spend in these communications with either, you know, kind of empty platitudes about the coronavirus or actually speculating on that, probably, not necessary and probably has the counter effect than you want it to have.
Do you agree, Mota?
Totally. This situation, there is no need for extra pros, and it should be avoided. There is a lot of information coming at LPs, and what they want is the meaty stuff about the actual actions and the actual status and the actual, reserves, sustainability of the portfolio companies, not the loan signature block and the musing on the broader situation. It's just what the actual impact is right now, and not going out much further or even speculating on things like long-term supply chain impact, because we just don't know. We don't know the duration. We don't know when things are going to bounce back.
And I did have a question for you, Mona, that was touching on things that Mike and Gary were talking about. But rather than asking you about what's the best way to share bad news, I'll ask you, what are the worst ways to share bad news?
The worst ways to share bad news. The worst way to share bad news would be to not preview it at all and share it via an email after it's a done deal, basically. So don't do that. Do as everybody's been saying, very frequent, very upfront, very open, previewing what you know when you know it, and being very clear about what you know and what you don't know. And, you know, I would say the Governor Cuomo approach is one to be emulated. Don't be overly optimistic. Be focused on the facts that you have them. Deliver it in a confident, sober manner, and deliver it frequently, and make sure people know when to expect the updates. You know, if you're going to be back to them in 2 weeks, tell them that. If you're going to be back to them in 4 weeks, well, frankly, that's probably too long in this environment, but tell them that so they know what to expect, and they know if they should be calling you in the interim, know that they're not missing any information.
Great. We have a few more minutes, so maybe we can kind of make this a speed round. I'll throw it over to Mike. Since we were talking about virtual fundraising, and setting aside that, you know, you're never going to give money to someone that you haven't personally met. But in the meantime, if you as an LP are trying to learn about some fund or some opportunity, what's the most essential stuff that you want to learn in the data room?
Well, I think the contents of a data room don't change. I think GPs know what the LPs want, right? History, track record, bios, relationships, just all that standard information that you have. Because quite frankly, LPs are working just as hard from home as they were in their offices, and they actually have time to crunch a lot of this information and see who is out there and what they're up to. It may not yet be actionable because they need to have their process back in place, but that doesn't mean you can't share all the information that you can. You have to be very careful that this is a time where being aggressive and being too aggressive could work against you, because this is where bad feelings start. But I think, look, the shock has worn off. I think once the first round of board meetings have taken place between the CIOs and their boards, their trustees, their investment committees, I think there's more clarity in where they're going forward. So I think GPs should start sharing all that information with them.
Mona, thoughts on the most essential items in a virtual fundraising environment?
In virtual data room, same. I mean, I would say the same. It doesn't change. There is perhaps going to be more focus on how the GP has done in prior crisis situations, whether it's an individual portfolio company or prior recession. There will certainly need to be opportunities to access the people if it is going to happen virtually. And we do know of at least one example where operational due diligence was completed virtually and a commitment made. So some LPs are figuring out how to do that, but being able to put as much of that on the data room, perhaps things that previously the GP wanted to keep for in-office review, that might be a change. A more carefully permissioned section of the data room that includes maybe some detailed deal memos, deal due diligence that otherwise they don't put in their standard data room, might be something that needs to happen going forward.
Mm-hmm. We've covered this, and again, we only have a few minutes, but I'll ask it anyway. notwithstanding that, you know, Mike talked about how a lot of LPs are actually in pretty good shape, nevertheless, do we expect that there might be some defaults or situations like that if things get worse? I'll throw that out to anyone.
I remember in 2008, 2009, there was like the great myth of the other defaulting LP. And, you know, that was a very, very frequent question. It's like, I heard other LPs are defaulting. And it's like, and you'd ask if anyone could actually name those. And there's like, well, there's one Saudi group, family office, that defaulted to a European fund. Yeah, I don't. Yeah, it may happen. It didn't. It was more of a sort of a boogeyman in a decade, you know, 12 years ago than it was. So I would expect the same now. And I haven't heard as much rhetoric about it now as I did then. But maybe that will continue if this continues, you know, for longer than people expect.
Yeah, David, I think the reality. Oh, I'm sorry. I think the reality of defaults. The truth is, most institutions never default. The issue is they don't want to sell their other assets at such a huge discount and take the hit in order to invest in their private equity portfolio or make their payments on their closed-end funds. So I think that's the reality. So they don't actually happen, but those calls that are made saying, please slow down your capital call, it's because they want to hold out for another week until whatever may happen in the fixed income market allows them to sell in a more reasonable manner at a price that's more palatable. Because if you think of what happened the last time around, LPs, yeah, they made those phone calls. They didn't want to default. But the reality is they were selling their fixed income portfolio at fire sale prices. And yeah, their private equity portfolio did amazing, or their distressed portfolio, I should say. But it was at the expense of their fixed income. So I think, to Gary's point, the myth of the defaulting LP, maybe if we were talking about the high net worth space, that's a whole nother discussion we could have a whole separate webinar on. But institutions in general will make their capital calls.
Mona, thoughts on capital calls and possible defaults, mythical or otherwise?
Well, I would agree. I think, you know, default, that's really more a high net worth issue. And to the extent people do need to address the denominator effect, we're going to have, you know, an active secondary market down the road and plenty of appetite for that. In terms of capital calls, you know, some GPs are going out with indications, even if they're very early, very preliminary, broad brush, just at the fund level, about what they're expecting at this point they might need to call. And, you know, that would be a situation where that number might be wrong to our prior conversation. But any sort of, you know, indication of magnitude is very helpful just for LP planning as they're thinking about their other capital calls and what might be coming in, if anything, at this point.
Great. Well, you know, we've been getting a lot of questions about AGMs and virtual fundraisings, many of them quite technical. Just so our audience knows, PrivCap does partner with groups to produce virtual AGMs and virtual fundraisings. And if you have any questions at all, please reach out to us. And we'll be contacting several of you in the audience that have had very technical questions. But I'd like to thank now my three experts, Gary, Mona, and Mike, for sharing their expertise with us today. It's much appreciated. I hope I can have the three of you back on a future PrivCap webinar, and I hope it's in happier times.